Meta analyzed this on this week's Insights in Nursing. Hi, this is Jamie Davis, and I'm here with another episode of Insights in Nursing, and we've got a really packed panel for you today with some pretty interesting issues to discuss. And I'll start off with a brand new addition to the show, and hopefully she'll be able to come back and join us in future episodes. But I was really excited to get Amy Romano on here, and Amy is the author of the Science and Sensibility blog, and some of you may know her on Twitter as, I'm going to get this right, Midwife Amy on Twitter. Amy, welcome to Insights in Nursing.
Thanks, Jamie. I'm really excited to be here. And I also hope that this won't be a one-time affair.
Well, I tell everybody, you are welcome to come back anytime. I'll just add you to the email list. And if you're available when we have the recording set up for the week, just feel free to come on.
Great.
We also have another first-time addition, but a lot of you who listen to podcasts may know him very well. Paul Bond is the podcaster and host of the Emergency Nursing Today podcast. We find that over at the ProMed Network with my shows and a lot of other great medical programs. But Paul, great to have you on the show. It's been a long time since you and I have done a podcast together.
This is true, Jamie. Thanks for having me on. I'm hoping to also do a lot more of these.
Well, you're welcome anytime as well. And we're going to head back in, and our originator, the original two members of my panel that have been here since the beginning, Kim McAllister from the Emergia blog.
Hi, Jamie.
How are you?
Okay, doing good.
And Terry Pollock, straight back from a one-week hiatus to deal with furniture flooding.
It was dramatic. Stop laughing.
We just wondered where you were, and when you said you had a furniture flood to deal with, we weren't quite sure what that meant. But we're glad to have you back, safe and sound. And if not all the furniture was saved, at least some of it was saved. Correct?
We'll see. It was traumatic. Noah's Ark sprang a leak, and well. I can't talk about it. I'm still suffering.
All right. Well, we wouldn't want to open any old wounds. So we'll go ahead and right into the meat of the show. And the meat of the show this week really is pertaining to a great blog article that Amy posted over on her blog. And it's entitled Meta-Analysis, The Wrong Tool Wielded Improperly. And I think that's a great topic, because I think so often we hear about science from studies, but we don't really look in depth at how the science was performed. Is there any basis to the study? And Amy, you really pointed to some issues in a recently released meta-analysis study that really it seemed like the authors were proving a point that they had come in with preconceived notions.
Yeah, I think that's a likely scenario. I don't actually know these researchers. I'm active in that. So the meta-analysis was on the safety of home birth, and home birth is something that in the United States is there's only about fewer than 1% of women have home births, and many of those are the kind that the baby just kind of falls out before the woman doesn't realize she's in labor. So even fewer than 1% are having planned home births. And they're, because the numbers are so small in the United States, it's really hard to get a handle on what exactly the outcomes are of planned home birth compared with the typical scenario, which is hospital birth. And so, and as many of the listeners, I'm sure, can imagine, it's a pretty heated debate. Our culture doesn't really deem that as something that could possibly be safe. So there's a lot of people who just sort of immediately discredit it. But when you look more globally in other parts of the world, home birth is a little more integrated, or quite a bit more integrated, into the maternity care system. And in one country in particular, the Netherlands, a third of babies are born at home. And the whole entire maternity care system is midwife-led, and 75% of their mothers have their babies with midwives. So the issue that I took with this meta-analysis was that it really was not, it kind of muddied the issue more than it helped to, you know, determine what the ultimate safety of home birth was. And so there had been a lot of chatter in the blogosphere and, you know, on email and everything over the 4th of July weekend when this hit the scene about, you know, some of the flaws with the component studies. And I actually I kind of took a step back and said, is meta-analysis even helpful for this type of question with the, you know, studies that exist? And I decided it wasn't. And I would be happy to elaborate about why.
Well, certainly, go for it.
So meta-analysis, which I obviously am a fan of meta-analysis. I think there's a use for it, but I think it really needs to be done carefully, and that there are negative effects of studying issues with meta-analysis, and that it sort of separates the reader from the individual studies or the primary research itself. So you really kind of lose access to your ability to critically analyze the component studies. And when the component studies are well done, or the meta-analysis researchers really take the time to talk about how they determined the quality of the studies that they included, and, you know, which studies they excluded and why, and which studies they included and why, then, you know, you can sort of trust the meta-analysis more. But none of that happened in this case. And the other thing that was going on was that 94% of the data from planned home births came from one large Dutch home birth study, where they have, you know, again, like I said, a third of babies born at home. So even though it's a much smaller country, the volume of planned home births is much higher. But more importantly than that, they have databases where they're really doing excellent data collection and analysis. And here in the United States, the study that seems to be quoted most often by opponents of planned home birth is a birth certificate study, a study that relies on birth certificate data. And it's a real mess. And it really is, I don't think it's defensible at all to include that in any kind of systematic review or meta-analysis of home birth, because they weren't able to differentiate planned from unplanned home births. They clearly included some preterm births and unattended births. And we know from another study that also just came out this week, the lead author on that study name is Eugene DeClercq. He's at the School of Public Health at Boston University. He used CDC data to show that there's a major difference in the outcomes between unplanned and planned home births, which makes sense to me, having attended many home births and had two babies at home. I go to a home birth with a lot of supplies that I can, you know, first of all, with a lot of clinical knowledge to handle all kinds of situations, and with medicines and IVs and, you know, supplies and a backup plan and a relationship with the hospital. And, you know, I understand how to diagnose and make a decision to transfer a woman. And when you don't have any of that, I can certainly imagine how babies would be born in worse shape. So this meta-analysis, the timing of it was also really suspicious, because there are some bills that are going through in New York and Massachusetts, and a lot of high-profile political movement around this issue. And the study was slated to be published in the September journal issue of the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and they started the publicity on it early, and a lot of people think that was a direct response to some of the publicity around the movement in New York and Massachusetts toward independent practice for nurse midwives, so we wouldn't have to have you know, written practice agreements and or supervisory language in our and greater access to planned home birth. So that's kind of the backstory and the meta-analysis, because they had this huge Dutch trial that contributed 94% of the data for planned home birth, which showed no different. I mean, it was remarkably similar, the outcomes of the babies and in the planned home and planned hospital birth groups. And then when they added all these other studies, some of which had data collection from births that occurred in 1976 and the, you know, early 80s, and then they had this one study with the birth certificates that had, excess perinatal mortality in the home birth group, you suddenly get 3 times greater neonatal mortality in the planned home birth group. And that's just really not borne out at all in the sort of relatively small subgroup of very high quality home birth studies that have come out in the last couple of years. So one of which, that Dutch study, is large enough to detect a clinically and statistically significant difference in perinatal and neonatal mortality. So that was my issue with the study. And I think, there's a larger issue of just this idea that the very best thing that you can do is a meta-analysis or a systematic review. And as long as you have it and it's in a peer-reviewed journal, then you don't have to look any further than that. It's sort of like, I think in the post I said, the evidence-based stamp of approval. And the idea that a poorly done meta-analysis will trump, a really, really high quality, trial or observational study is problematic to me, especially when we're looking at really complex phenomena that have to do either with, when you look at birth itself, it's a complex physiological phenomenon. And when you look at maternity care systems, the same is true. So just, it's not the same, I think, as studying a drug or, a certain screening test or something like that, that I think lends itself a little better to these tools and where you really can just, pile all the data into a meta-analysis software and have better evidence. I think when you pile all the data into this meta-analysis software, you end up with much more problematic evidence in this case.
Well, and I've always, it's funny, until I started educating myself better, I always assumed that these journals were vetting the science, that the whole idea of a peer-reviewed journal was to have some oversight over when things were published, that there was they were following good science practices, that the conclusions seemed to make sense. But we see this, and I see this all the time in other healthcare areas where the science just doesn't, it seems like the conclusions were drafted and then the science was put together to support the conclusions. And that may not be the underlying premise of these authors. I'm not trying to put words in their mouths, but it seems I've seen this type of thing happen before, and that seemed to be the case in those other situations. Kim, you had some ideas about this, and talking about home birth and the people that you've seen, and I come from an area with a lot of a large Amish community with a lot of home births. They seem to work fine in our region. We do see some complications, but they are usually managed by the on-site midwives. When an ambulance responds or when they come into the ER, the patient is usually being very well cared for, and we're just providing support for the ongoing care that's already been started.
I agree. In the Bay Area, there seems to be a fair amount of home births. I see a lot of moms not during the process of birth or the intrapartum period, but I see them bringing in their babies within a month or 2 months for whatever reason they're coming to the ER for. And many have had home births, and it's usually their second or third home birth. So, and when we discuss it, they have nothing but positive things to say about it. But these were planned home births with a midwife in attendance. So, but it looked like reading the Amy's article, it just seemed as though that was the plan, was to put whatever you could put together to then spew out the result that you wanted. That's just reading it. That's what it seems like. I don't understand how a neonatal death that occurs 28 days after birth could be considered an intrapartum death. I mean, a lot can happen within that first month. I'm confused by what they included.
Yeah, they also included at least one study, because I was familiar with most of the studies that they included just from having written on this topic before. And so one of the Australian studies that they included enrolled women early in their pregnancy, in their pregnancy they decided to have a home birth. That's when they were enrolled into the study. And so there were 3 neonatal deaths in that in that group, and I don't remember what the N was, you know, how many total. It was somewhere in the, like, close to 1,000, I believe. And one was from low birth weight, which presumably is, you know, not necessarily, but presumably would have been a preterm baby or a baby with an anomaly. And so, you know, obviously a woman who says, at, you know, 20 weeks, let's say, hey, I think I want to have a home birth, and then goes into labor at 33 weeks, she's not in that moment at 33 weeks planning a home birth. She's like, oh, wait, I'm in preterm labor. I got to go to the hospital. And her midwife is maybe assessing her and sending her to the hospital. And if that baby goes on to die, then that has nothing to do with the planned place of birth. It might have to do with the antepartum care that the midwife provided, but that's a different issue. And so of the three deaths, one was low birth weight, one was SIDS, which, again, that isn't related to intrapartum events, and the other was infection, which we don't know for sure. And we also certainly know that infections occur in hospital setting as well. So, the Dutch study that I referred to looked at intrapartum deaths and deaths, neonatal deaths up to 7 days. And, you know, obviously some babies could it's possible that a baby could suffer an intrapartum insult and die, you know, and kind of linger and hang on for longer than a week. But in general, I think that was a good way to approach the issue, is to look at intrapartum and then the early neonatal mortality. But to go to 28 days and say that that's better. And by the way, the meta-analysis didn't find any difference in perinatal mortality, which includes all of the deaths from 20 weeks gestation through the neonatal period. So it was like, you know, they kind of played around. I got the sense they played around with the data until they found something significant, and not to mention made, you know, really didn't support why they included some of these studies with discredited methodology. So I think it's, you know, and I honestly don't know why any individual obstetrician or the larger, you know, obstetrician groups would care so much about home birth, because it affects so few women. But I think it really is a fundamental issue to them. Like, what, why do we need all of this technology and all of these obstetricians for women to give birth if you don't really need any of that for it to happen safely? So that's my only guess, like, why people get so passionate about this issue and try to generate these really flawed and I think biased studies to show that it's more risky. And so I don't know if it's turf wars or what, but I certainly know that, there has been a major consumer movement, as you said, and so many of these women have had home births, myself included. I wouldn't trade it for the world. It was really the best experience. I felt like I was doing the healthiest thing for myself, and the studies universally show that it's better, more safe for the woman, including a lower risk of having cesarean surgery and, you know, many other complications. And so, so we're really just talking about the baby, which obviously anybody, you know, we want healthy babies too, not just healthy moms, but it's a really specific, harm that they're looking at. But there's a big consumer movement around this. There's some political action in a lot of states to try to regulate midwifery and bring it out from underground, because in a lot of places, in a lot of parts of this country, home birth midwifery is illegal. We're trying to create a system where we can actually begin to understand better, you know, who should be having home births and who should really be hospitalized, and how to integrate those systems so that when a midwife is at home with a woman who's encountering trouble, she can pick up the phone and the hospital really has a system and they've gone through drills, or they, you know, the EMT who shows up understands, like, hey, this is a planned home birth, and understands the, everybody can kind of collaborate to have a safe outcome. But that's not the reality at all right now. And really those of us advocating for you know, on the side of home birth are saying, you know, home birth is never going to be for every woman, but there's always going to be some women who will do it, whether it's legal or not. And we're seeing women doing it with no attendance, planning home births without any midwives, and doing home births when they have breech babies or other, you know, risk factors where they really, it's a bigger risk to be at home. And it's, I think it's a much bigger kind of it says a lot about what's going on in a bigger way about our maternity care system, with so little choice and so little patient-centeredness and really a lot of excess use of technologies that can harm women and babies. So it's a bigger debate, and this meta-analysis came at a time when there was a lot of activity and some awakening among people. You know, in New York, literally just a couple of weeks ago, they passed this. They got rid of the need for a written practice agreement, and so midwives can now practice, you know, truly independently and in more of a with the obstetrician as a consultant rather than somebody that needs to sign off on any, you know, everything. So this all happened in political context, and the idea that a peer-reviewed journal is immune to the political context, I think, is wrong. And I mean, I'm a peer reviewer for a journal, and it's a volunteer gig. You know, like I don't know that I was vetted all that there, you know, vigorously for the role, because I think they're always in need of more reviewers. There's the peer review process has been studied and found that it doesn't decrease fraud or, you know, poor practice, you know, research practice. And so,
Amy, yeah. who was behind the meta analysis? Who was there? Where'd the funding come from to do this research? Do you know?
That's a good question. I don't know where the funding came. One would assume it says so. The group is up in Maine, and they are OBGYNs and, you know, related researchers who I had never heard of, other than that they themselves have done some analysis of birth certificates and also found excess issues in the home birth group. But again, there's the problem of, you know, birth certificates not being a very reliable source for information on that. So I looked up the researchers to see what else they've published on, and it's all, you know, very complicated OB stuff that isn't related to, you know, the care of, you know, the conduct of physiologic care for labor and birth, which is the standard home birth. So I don't know them as in the research community, and I don't know what their motivations were, but I think that it helps to understand home birth and to maybe have been to one or two if you want to study it. I mean, yeah, you can, I don't know. It's just a totally completely different. It's like going to Mars versus Jupiter, you know, in terms of thinking, you know, what happens at a home birth when all you've seen is some births in the hospital. It's just a very, very different style of care. And so, in order to do a meta-analysis of it, I guess you could argue you don't need to have done home birth or been to home births. But I think to really put yourself out there as somebody who has the universal truth about the safety of home birth, you need to be a little bit more part of the conversation and not just put out this study and call it a day.
I think Kim asked a very valid question. Follow the money. If you want to know if a research project is valid, the first thing you have to do is ask who's funding this. Mark Twain said, figures don't lie, but liars figure. And unfortunately, a lot of these research projects now are being funded, are being conducted by Washington, D.C. think tanks. And the first question you have to ask is, who's fronting these people? These think tanks tend to be a front for people with interest in industry. There's a lot of K Street connections here in Washington, D.C. with these think tanks. And the fact that this bill or this research corresponds with some legislation that is on the front burner right now doesn't surprise me in the least. So I think Kim's on to something. If you really want to know how valid this thing is, find out who financed it.
Yeah, I think that's true. And, you know, I am very aware of the conflict of interest kind of stuff that happens with industry. And but as somebody who mostly looks at maternity care research, I am not in the practice of really following the money in that same way that you might if, you know, we all heard about the diabetes drug today, or, you know, that's been in the news about how they were hiding data about, I think it was Avandia, but I don't want to disparage the wrong drug. But, you know, because literally almost nobody is studying drugs in pregnant women, I'm not used to sort of following pharmaceutical money, which is another issue all in and of itself. But, you know, I'm looking at it now to see if I can find the funding, but I don't see it, which is a problem if they don't even say what the source of funding was. But I know,
which would make me very suspicious.
Right. Yeah. So, I assume maybe it was ACOG, which is the American College of OBGYNs, who they have a good president right now. I wouldn't say he's supportive of home birth, but he's definitely supportive of midwives. And but as an organization, they have come down with a policy against planned home birth. And, they may well be behind this. That's what a lot of people believe.
It still comes down to a political ploy, if you will, or another political tool, kind of like you were mentioning about pharmaceuticals. I follow pharmaceuticals very closely. I do a lot of blogging on pharmaceuticals and big pharma, if you will. And it is Avandia, as a matter of fact, that the FDA is studying today, because there are three studies that conflict each other as to is it advantageous, is it not, does it cause cardiovascular problems in healthy people, does it not? And I really think they're going to shoot it down, but they're finding that the problem was that these studies were funded by the manufacturers of Avandia. They have a vested interest in making sure that it looks good.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of studies end up coming out like that, that people just don't realize. They don't read to the end and look at the conflict of interest statements or find out who actually did fund the study. They just find the basic statistics, if you will. They'll read the beginning synopsis and run with the basic data that they find, not realizing what the truth is behind the study that was done.
Yeah, I know. I really, you know, I started the Science and Sensibility blog about a year and a half ago, but before that, Science and Sensibility is a Lamaze International blog. And so I've been working for Lamaze even longer, doing sort of summing up research and all that. And I've been involved in this work for a total of seven years or so, writing about research. And I was trained during this kind of era when it was all about evidence-based practice, and how, you know, all of these problems that we see with childbirth and the rising rate of cesarean section, and, you know, maternal deaths are on the rise for the first time, and we're just seeing no progress toward lowering things like the preterm birth rate and whatnot. But anyway, so it was sort of like this delirious enthusiasm that evidence-based practice was going to save the day, because once we start generating evidence and seeing what the effects are of the practices around pregnancy and childbirth, we would know, it has to, you know, midwives need to be caring for a greater proportion of women, and we need to be doing, you know, fewer inductions and whatever it is. And it just has not happened. And I think that that's because, like we said, I think before we started recording, you can create evidence to almost support anything you want to say. This like idea of decision-based evidence making instead of evidence-based decision making. And I found that as somebody whose job has for the last 7 years been to communicate about research, it's become more and more complex, because even Cochrane systematic reviews, which are the gold standard for systematic reviews and meta-analysis, I find a lot of trouble in several of those. I don't, you know, I really need to look closely at those individually before I can say, yeah, this is a solid piece of research. And because there's so many ways that bias can creep in, even in randomized controlled trials. And there's, of course, publication bias. You only get to read about this, you know, the studies that the journals want you to read about, or that, you know, get submitted in the first place. And then there's the media bias. I mean, the media spin on this has been huge. It definitely was picked up in a number of places, and they're not picking apart the meta-analysis or pulling the individual studies to see if they belonged in the meta-analysis. So it's like this whole PR machine kicks into gear, because this was, you know, the journal started this publicity thing on it, and they called it editor's choice. And, you know, it's just like, oh God, now we have this to deal with. So I really like Health News Review. They haven't done anything on this particular study, but I like that as a that's a website that will pick apart media reports of different research studies to say, you know, to apply very specific criteria to see if they're doing a good job communicating the outcomes of research and, you know, talking about conflicts of interest and that kind of thing. So, I mean, there are tools out there and services to help people make sense of this, but you really, it's not an easy task by any stretch of the imagination. And it's a much more critical and nuanced set of skills than just knowing what the latest study says and kind of, you know, knowing about what a randomized controlled trial is and all those things that they teach you in your statistics class. So if you've even had one of those.
Well, and that's the challenge. I mean, I the question I would ask of all of you, and maybe we'll start with Paul here, because you were talking about that you do a lot of writing and reading about pharmaceuticals. Do you find that most of your colleagues in nursing understand how to objectively read a study when it's published, or do they do what the news does and grab the headline and run with it? Paul, did we lose Paul? We may have lost Paul. Okay, well, I will throw that out to the rest of you, and maybe Terry could come in, or whoever. Do we find that other nurses read objectively good scientific studies and look at them and understand what they're saying?
My experience was more, I didn't even really, it's embarrassing, but I didn't really know how to do that until I had taken my nursing research course. And in my original nursing education as an associate degree nurse did not include that skill in or any information on research, at least 30 years ago. That may have changed now. But until I took an actual research course that taught me how to critically look at these research studies, I grabbed the results. And I would think, okay, well, you know, here's all this blah, 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 blah. And then I would go to the discussion area and take what I could from the end of the research study. Until I learned how to, and learned not only how, but that I had better read those things from, you know, stem to stern to get the full impact of exactly what they did. There are so many areas in research where, you know, you can lose credibility in a study. And it's not always just the discussion that is the most important. So now I do. Do my colleagues do it? I don't know. They don't really. Some of them, I will discuss the latest things that are going on or what I've read on the web. But for the most part, we don't discuss research.
I think I became aware of how biased research is through my nursing practice. I've never taken an advanced class in statistics. But as a psychiatric nurse, we deal with a lot of drug dependence, okay? And back in the, I would say, late 70s, early 80s, when I was starting my nursing practice and getting more into psych, we would get these little old ladies coming in, these little grandmas who were hooked on Valium. And I very innocently one day asked one of the psychiatrists I worked with, how did this happen? And he said that originally Valium was deemed a medication you couldn't get hooked on because the research showed that dependency was not going to be an issue, and doctors were encouraged by the drug manufacturer to prescribe copious amounts of Valium because it was pretty much harmless. And the upshot of the story was it was all about the money, that patients were harmed by this, and we were on our unit seeing the fallout of some faulty research. And that story stuck with me. And from that point on, I've always looked at any sort of research coming out as new and, you know, like this is the cutting edge stuff. I've always been very jaded and very suspicious.
Yeah. And Terry, I think that raises another point that is certainly true in maternity care, and I assume it's true elsewhere too, that evidence infuses into practice quicker when it's telling us something new to do, another drug to prescribe or whatever, but it's much harder to get providers to stop doing something that they've done because new evidence has come out. So unless it's real clear, like this drug is killing people or, you know, the drug, it's so bad it gets pulled off the market, you just, I don't think that infuses into practice nearly as quickly. And so so we're seeing that with, there was a study recently on it was a quality improvement study in maternity care where they were trying to use episiotomy less to get in line with the evidence that there's really very few cases where episiotomy is necessary and it is associated with harms. And they were trying to use Pitocin in the third stage of labor more because there's some evidence that it improves outcomes in terms of postpartum hemorrhage. And we saw in that study that they were very effective at using more Pitocin and much less effective at bringing down the episiotomy rate. And it was just... That was another example for me that once providers are used to prescribing, whether it's Valium or cutting episiotomies or whatever it is, it takes a really, you know, first of all, the provider needs to hear about the new research and understand the impact of that new research. And then they need to really kind of admit to themselves that they've been wrong. And, you know, even when you can say, well, I've been wrong because the research wasn't there yet, or we thought we were doing the right thing, it's still... I think kind of a difficult thing at the ego level to say, you know, I need to do things a different way. And then it's also just human behavior to keep kind of doing things the way we've been doing. So I think something we see with evidence-based practice as well.
You know, I think Paul's back with us. Paul, are you there?
Yes, Jamie, I am.
Okay. I know you had to step away for just a second, but we were asking the question, do you find that other nurses that you know are really knowledgeable about reading research studies and do they just grab the conclusion and run with it?
I actually find nurses don't do as much research reading as they probably should, at least with the nurses that I have a lot of contact with. They don't read journals as much as they probably should and don't stay up as much as they could on a lot of the new and emerging topics or new and emerging sciences. And those that do pretty much do like we're saying. They grab the title or the basics of the article and run with it without actually understanding the true analysis of what they're talking about or the background of the researchers or what have you and look at it more from an objective standpoint. I'm also finding physicians don't necessarily have the time to do that like they used to. Physicians, especially with pharmaceuticals, tend to rely on the pharmaceutical reps to impart the knowledge to them. And I find this is a problem because the pharmaceutical reps are hired by who? The pharmacies to push the medications. So obviously it's all going to be slanted. And that's what I've been seeing at least in the past 10 years or so anyways.
Well, I think it just goes to show we need to work on our skills, and we need to become more objective readers. And I think we could all stand, and that, I mean nurses and healthcare professionals in general need to be the people who our public can go to ask a question when they read about something in the newspaper. We should be able to look at a research study and be able to make some general decisions on some of the validity of at least the methodology. We may not know the topic area as far as the specialty, but we should be able to look at the research methodology and make a determination, at least preliminarily, about the methods of used in the research. Amy, would you agree?
Yeah, I would. And definitely. And I think it's, you know, I don't really know what the solution is, but we've reached a point where no care provider, whether it's a nurse or doctor or whoever, can keep up on all the literature in their field. So we need to also have better tools for nurses to really critically analyze, but boil it down for them so that, you know, we're all busy and we can't keep up on everything. But I want to put in a plug, if I may, for a series that's on my blog at scienceandsensibility.org. One of my contributors named Andrea Lithgow does a series called Understanding Research, and it's written for childbirth educators, actually, many of whom, you know, depending on their background, they may not have had a formal statistics class. But I've gotten a lot of feedback from nurses and midwives and others that it's a nice just kind of primer to start from scratch and really understand how to read a paper. And by the way, there's also a wonderful book. The author is Tricia Greenhall, and it's called How to Read a Paper. And I think I learned more about critical analysis from that book, which is like $30 and such an easy read compared with my nursing texts on research. So I really, she's British, Tricia, and I think British people write in a little bit more of an engaging way than Americans do about research. So I'll put in a plug for those two things as really good resources for nurses.
Would you send me the link to that? And
yeah, sure.
I'll put it in the show notes when we release the episode later this week. I'll make sure that the listeners can head over to insightsinnursing.com and find the links to your blog and to the specific article, because that kind of a resource is, I think, really invaluable.
Great. Sure will.
Well, let's shift in topic a little bit. We had another link come up, and looking at just misconceptions about nurses and what we do and where nursing comes from and what it means to be a nurse in a nurse profession. And it comes from a good friend of mine's blog, actually. Chris Kaiser is a paramedic who writes the Life Under the Lights blog. And generally, I don't think he has anything against nurses, but he was writing an article about paramedics and EMTs and relating them to the spork. That's right, that thing you get at the 7-Eleven, it's not a spoon, and it's not a fork, it's a spork. And he was saying, you know, paramedics and EMTs are that, you know, one-size-fits-all tool that filled in a hole in the healthcare system to take care of the pre-hospital environment. In the midst of that discussion, he talked about how all the other pieces of the healthcare system fit together. And he made the comment that, you know, nurses are the, you know, the natural assistants to doctors. And I read that and I cringed, because as I just have to say, you know, as a paramedic, before I became a nurse, I really had no idea what nurses did. I didn't know anything more than what I might have guessed just based on inference. And so Chris, I want to say first off, don't go over there and blast Chris. He's a nice guy. He has nothing but respect for nurses. I'm going to make sure he gets a heads up that this show is being released, because I think he has a lot of good things to say in the article. I think he's just repeating a common misconception about what it is that nurses do. And should I let Kim go first on this, Terry?
Batten down the hatches.
Well, let me read the sentence. Nurses and their modern incarnation as the registered professional nurse, or RN, developed as the, ready for this, ultimate assistant to the physician. And then down a few more paragraphs, it talks about how all nurses, no matter what their specialty, can probably change a bedpan, start an IV, pass medication, or lend a caring smile in the same manner. Okay.
Yeah, so, notice he started with bedpans.
Yes, yes. And I couldn't finish the post because I was fuming, so I left a message as a comment and then said I would go back, and now I'm reading even more stuff now that I've read the rest of it. And I don't think that Chris, my sense was that he wasn't being derogatory at all. I think he actually honestly views nurses in this way, and he's not alone. I think society is still, in the 21st century, has little idea about what nursing entails. And I'm really surprised that someone as, I assume, young as Chris today will still have that opinion or that viewpoint, but I think he just put into writing what a great deal of society still thinks. What we do seems to be, even though we're the ones at the bedside 24/7, the ones that go into the home 24/7, we're still, what we do seems to be invisible.
Well, and I think part of that, at least, is our own fault, Kim. I mean, nursing has truly come a long way since its infancy 200 plus years ago. When nurses actually were handmaidens to a physician back in the day. And we do have our own specialized body of knowledge and understanding, and there are specific things that we do that physicians don't and no other healthcare professional does. But we've done a terrible job at educating the public on that. The only thing in recent memory that I can think of where nursing actually stood up en masse and said, wait a second, was ER. When ER first came out, the nurses were portrayed as handmaidens to the physician in the emergency department. And the ENA en masse, all 36,000 members plus, wrote the show's producer and said, wait a second, this is not what we do. You are not portraying us like this. And they actually got the ENA involved in the show to show nursing in a more professional light as nurses are in the emergency department. But if you look at modern drama shows today, if you will. You have Hawthorne RN. There's another one over on Showtime. I don't remember the name of it right off the bat.
Nurse Jackie.
That's it. But we're being portrayed as these individuals that either are superhuman and can do everything and run through the hospital and make physicians cow down to us and so over the top that you know it can't be true, or we're sniveling in the corner and patting people on the head that are sick and holding their hands and saying, oh, it'll be all right, honey, and waiting for the physician to make a decision. So whose fault is it that society looks at nurses basically as second-class citizens to a doctor in the hospital? It's ours. We've perpetuated this whole image of nursing as being nothing but a handmaiden to physicians.
I would say that the media has done that. There are nurses who are, what am I trying to say? They give their technical advisors to Hawthorne, and it doesn't matter. She's still running out of her house at 5 o'clock in the morning to stop somebody from jumping off the hospital roof. Nurse Jackie, from what I'm understanding, because I don't watch the show, I decided not to watch it when she was a, you know, drug addict, having sex in the pharmacy to get her Percocet or whatever it is she snorts.
Right.
That, according to the a couple of Suzanne Gordon's and the Truth About Nursing, that is, none of that matters. But Nurse Jackie apparently in the emergency department functions in a very realistic way in terms of taking care of patients. And I can't vouch for that because I haven't actually ever watched it. I did get flipped out when it first started with the trailers, but I don't know that it's nursing's fault. I mean, we try to write letters and say, you are really off the wall here. But the media will do what the media will do. You know, there was as an example that isn't nursing, there was a technical advisor on CHIPS. My dad was a highway patrolman at the time. There was a technical advisor on CHIPS who used to say, I tell them, not this, not this, not this, and they would do it anyway. So it doesn't matter if they're showing nursing correctly or appropriately to the media. I think every part of the – I think I agree with you to a certain extent that we – it's our fault in that we as nurses don't tend to be real verbal about what we do or the responsibilities we have. We're not hired independently. We are usually the employers of the physicians. Our services are lumped into the hospital room charge, just like housekeeping. So in that case, I would say, yeah, but I would think the media has done a bigger disservice, but I don't know how much control we have over the media.
Well, I don't know. I have a problem with saying it's just the media's fault, because nursing traditionally had been a subservient type of organization. And if you look back in the history of nursing, even Florence Nightingale said that we were supposed to be second to the physician. We were supposed to be there to help the physician. So there's always been this class difference, if you will, that nurses were subservient to physicians. And the healthcare system has kind of bred a lot of that also. If you look at how nurses are looked at within the hospital, nurses don't realize a lot of times, and I have this conversation with nurses that I work with on a routine basis, we have a license just like a physician has a license. I am a professional licensed individual just on the same lines as a physician or a lawyer, but they don't realize that. I can actually hang my shingle out for private practice to do private duty nursing just like a physician can. Now, granted, society doesn't look at nursing in that respect, but that again is a perception issue. If you look at any other industry or any other profession, a perception issue starts with the profession. And if you want to change the perception of society, then the profession needs to be the one that's standing up being vocal, saying, wait a second, we're professionals. We can do these things without a physician's order. We have our own body of knowledge. There are many things that we do that you don't understand, and let us educate you on this. But nursing, like you said, nurses don't tend not to be that verbal, and I think that's where the bigger problem comes in.
Agreed.
Do we? I agree with you, Paul. I think we need to defend ourselves in this situation. And I know it's come up before on the show that Terry's mentioned it. I know Kim's mentioned it. I've run into this in my own travels to physicians' offices. A lot of times they have some sort of medical aid. They may not even have official medical aid training of any kind, but the physician often refers to that person as their nurse, and until they say it in front of a nurse, and
right,
and then you call them to task and say, you know, it's against the law to say you're a nurse if you're not.
Well, I've also noticed many people in healthcare that are allied professionals, if you will, CNAs or med techs or PCTs or whatever alphabet soup you want to put behind their name, call themselves nurses. And yet they're not. And again, the same thing, until you confront them with it and say, oh, what kind of a nurse are you? Oh, well, I'm an aide. Oh, well, did you realize that it's against the law to portray yourself as a nurse? Then they get very defensive. But again, society and the medical profession has kind of propagated this. If you look at the difference between nurse practitioners and physician's assistants, physician's assistants for years have had a better reputation than nurse practitioners up until recently with the push for healthcare reform and nurse practitioners and nurse midwives becoming more vocal, becoming more proactive, becoming more political in their stance. PAs were the ones that were getting the better jobs and better pay, and NPs were out there struggling. Why? Because the medical community, not the healthcare community in general, started it.
It's sort of ironic because they're right in their name, it's physician's assistant. Although right. I think them call themselves physician's associates now, but
that's the thing, Amy. Exactly like you're saying, they're physician's assistants. So. Mm-hmm. The physician started it as a person to help him that he controls. Right. The physicians can't control nurses because nurses have a profession and our own body of knowledge, and we've stood up to that. Mm-hmm. So the physician community understands that, but the rest of society doesn't understand that yet because we haven't stood up and taken that for ourselves yet.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, it's you know, I think that medicine is, you know, and I don't want to make sweeping generalizations, but it's very hierarchical, and something that doesn't sort of fit in a hierarchical structure nobody knows what to do with. So when it's, you know, I think medicine needs to become more collaborative. And, you know, I do think that some of the perception of nurses has to do with the media and with how non-nursing, you know, allied professionals are presenting themselves as nurses. I think some of it has to do with how some nurses present themselves, but I think a lot of it has to do with how medicine sees nursing. And I've certainly heard a lot of anecdotes from nurses who've been treated like an assistant in the course of their work. And so I think... I've heard some grumblings about healthcare. You know, the only way to really get more effective, reliable healthcare is through collaboration, and maybe through those types of conversations, we can see some change in how nursing is perceived and the value of the independent scope of nursing practice, even if we're all never going to work completely independently, at least RNs, of, you know, doctors and hospital systems and whatnot.
Well, I agree with that, Amy, and I think maybe that's a good place to stop. I'm sure we'll revisit this conversation in future episodes, because this seems to be a common theme popping up from time to time where people just misunderstand what we do. And I guess my call to action to the listeners of this show, presumably your nurses or nursing students are interested in nursing, that you really stand up for your profession and understand that your license sets you apart from most of the rest of the people in the healthcare community, and sets you alongside physicians in a very specific way with your nursing practice. And I just think that that's something we should keep in mind and be proponents and stand up when we read something in the local paper or see misconceptions being propagated, that we speak out against them, and letters to the editor and talking with our community leaders and making sure people understand exactly what it is we do.
I agree.
Absolutely.
Okay, well, let's wrap up, but I want to see where everybody is. Amy, where can we find more of you online?
You can find me at scienceandsensibility.org and on Twitter at the handle at @midwifeamy.
Excellent. Well, I welcome you back to the show anytime. We'll look forward to having you on for a future discussions.
Sounds good. Thank you.
And Paul, where can we find you online?
Online, I'm at emergencynursingtoday.com, and my links for both Facebook and Twitter are off of there.
Excellent. Terry?
I'm at Mother Jones, our nurseratchetsplace.com, and my Twitter name is Mother Jones RN.
Okay, I thought you were going to change it to like furniture nurse or something.
I'm thinking about it. Don't tempt me.
All right, Kim, last but not least.
Emergyblog.com, and that's my Twitter handle is Emergyblog.
And I'm Jamie Davis, and you can find me over at the Nursing Show podcast website, nursingshow.com. Of course, this show is found at insightsinnursing.com. And you can find this and a lot of other great podcasts over at the ProMed Network, promednetwork.com, with shows for nurses, for medical professionals at all levels, including physicians. So you can find all of that over there. Kim's building an addition in her home, so we will... Sounds like you've got like sawing and all kinds of stuff going on there, Kim.
Oh my God, I thought I had this muted the majority of the time.
We're on to you.
they're building like a deck overhead type thing out there. And I thought, can they hear this? Now, remember, I have headphones on, so it's not as loud to me. And here I had myself muted, I thought, the entire time. So I apologize for the hammering and sawing going on.
It's called ambiance.
Yeah. They're going to think this is a podcast for this old house.
Yeah, where's Bob Vila?
Yeah, well, hey, I could use Bob Vila around here. Let me tell you, there's a lot to do.
Well, great. Well, it's great to have you all on the show, and we'll try to get everybody together or another group together next week on Insights in Nursing.